Thank you so much for the kind introduction and also for the hospitality. I had heard that the hospitality here is great, but I didn't expect that you guys would bring the Prime Minister. So I'm very happy about that. So this research was initiated and conceptualized in Cambridge in the TCM group, and then most of the calculations were done in Princeton, hence this collection of logos here. So I'm going to be telling you a bit about this work on spinons and quantum squares, and I will define what spinons and what quantum squares is. I don't know what the audience here is comprised of in terms of expertise, so I would like to sort of introduce this a bit more broadly, but if it's too boring, I can go faster. Anyway, so what we're interested here is the dynamics of excitations in strongly correlated quantum systems. And in particular, we're interested in cases where we don't have, where we obviously don't have a very good understanding yet. So let me say first that there are systems where we have a very good understanding of what's going on. These are non-interacting systems, for example, where we have Dirac, Weyl, Majorana, fermions. And then basically to describe excitations, what you use is non-interacting theories. And there we are, you know, things are simpler and we sort of understand what's going on. Then we have correlated systems that are ordered in the Landau sense. So when you have an order parameter that's robust and then you think about excitations within an ordered medium, then what you can say is that you consider fluctuations of the order parameter, which then behave effectively as free particles. So then again, you end up with effectively free theories. So the challenge is, or one of the challenges is in states where you have no order in sight, and then you need to look for observable manifestations of the excitations you have in the material. So why are we interested in this? Well, because we would like to understand these non-trivial excitations and to make stuff with them, I don't know, like quantum toasters, I don't know, or whatever is shown over there. But in general, we need to understand the excitations first. and one way that has been put forward in order to do this is to study dynamic responses. By dynamic responses, I mean I have a system in its ground state, and then by hand or by an experimental method, I introduce an excitation in there. And I study how this excitation proliferates in this state. So by dynamic responses, I mean something that looks like this form here. So by this ket zero, I mean the ground state of a system. Then we have an operator that generates an excitation. And then we see basically which excited states we can access within the description of the state. So this is the ground state, these are excited states, and this is the difference, the energy difference between excited and ground state, and this is the energy we transfer to reach these excited states. So this gives us a spectrum, which is weight as a function of energy and momentum, and the expectation here is that whenever we have sharp bands in these spectral quantities, we expect that we have a well-formed and free excitation propagating in the system, right? And so, for example, what I write here, this generates a spin flip. This is a spin flip operator with a certain, let's say, wave vector. And this, for example, what you would see is a band of magnons. If you know this. This is indeed the case that you have like an ordered state, magnetically ordered state. However, the inverse relation is not that clear, unfortunately. So when you have free excitations, is it always true that I'm going to get sharp bands? And that depends. So to give you an example, This here is an old work. You can say that it is old because it's from before we could scan pages straight. So this is a very well ordered, this is how it looks on the journal. So anyway, so this is a very well ordered 3D antiferromagnet. And this is the quantity that I showed before, which is called the dynamic spin structure factor. It's basically the spectral quantity that, or the dynamic response that I talked about before. And you see that this thing, this is energy and wave vector. And you see that it forms a very sharp band. It's for three directions here, but you see that almost everything collapses onto a certain line. And this is what I mean by well-formed bands, where we have this excitation that we put in, and it sort of coherently propagates in the material. Now, this is another case where we do exactly the same thing. There's a caveat here. This is a one-dimensional material. This is a 3D material. But nevertheless, we do the same approach, do the same thing, but instead of getting a sharp line, what we get is a continuum of excitations, of spectral weight in this spectrum that is bounded by these black lines. So this tells us that obviously, I mean, these two cases are very different. And the reason for this is that here, the excitation that we put into the material breaks up into more than one, in this case, two. Right, and these are called spin-ons. But to tell you what spin-ons are, let me switch to the case at hand, which is spin-ice. So, what is a spin-on in spin-ice? First of all, let me tell you, like, really, from a reductionist point of view, what is spin-ice? Spin-ice is the Ising antiferromagnet on the pyrochlore lattice in three dimensions, essentially. Basically, pictorially, how you can think about this is that you have a lattice of tetrahedra, as the one shown here, and then you impose a condition, or your Hamiltonian imposes a condition, that these, that the spins on each tetrahedron obey the so-called ice rule. And this ice rule means that you will have always two spins pointing out and two spins pointing in the tetrahedron. Okay, so the Hamiltonian, like this, let's say the antiferromagnetic Ising model, will give you an extensive degeneracy of low energy states because there are many configurations that obey this rule. And above these configurations, you have these excitations where you flip one spin and you make two violations of this rule, right? So you can see, for example, let's look here. You have these two ice rule obeying tetrahedra, and let's say that I flip this spin from pointing in to pointing out, I will get two violations of the rule. Now, if you consider the effects of temperature, I'm speaking all classically now, what can happen is that spins can flip due to temperature also in the case where you already have excitations in the material, right? So you have a finite density, and then you can imagine, for example, that I take this spin. Here you see there's a violation of the rule. I have three in and one out. But now let's say that due to temperature effects, we have this spin flip. This will repair this tetrahedron, but it will break this one. And this basically what this does is it propagates this violation. And because these violations locally in each tetrahedron, when they are next to each other, they form a dipole. And with this process, you can show, you know, beautifully in both theory and experiment that these two violations can be stretched arbitrarily far away from each other. This is why we call them monopoles, right? Now, this is what I'm not going to talk about. Like, I'm going to talk about quantum effects here. So, and to make things simpler, it's going to be all at zero temperature, right? And at zero temperature, these excitations are forbidden in the first place, right? Because there's no thermal fluctuation that can bring them in. However, what can happen, and what is more, like more recent development, you can read the reviews on this progress, is that you can have quantum mechanical fluctuations even at zero temperature, right? And in this In this regime, things become more interesting, because now if you put these excitations in there, now due to the quantum mechanical fluctuations, these are endowed with quantum dynamics, right? So now they don't proliferate just classically, but they become delocalized objects, or at least that's what we expect, okay? And now, sorry, now if you consider this this process of excitations, either real excitations or virtual excitations above the ground state, you see that this extensive manifold of ground states can become a coherent superposition of all these states and become a real quantum state. And this state is called quantum spin ice, okay? And this is a phase diagram or a cartoon of a phase diagram of what might be happening. You will have this quantum spin ice state down here when your material is totally disordered, but then you might apply, let's say, a magnetic field at zero temperature and sort of align your spins a certain way, force them to be aligned, and then you'll have a phase transition to an ordered state as a function of the field. In this case, we know what to expect from before, right? This is an ordered state. We know that we have an order parameter. The fluctuation of the order parameter can be treated as a free particle. So when we evaluate a spectral quantity, we expect to see sharp bands. And this is comparison for this compound here between experiment and theory. And you see indeed in the experiment these bands, and then you can reproduce their location, the dispersion, beautifully. Now, what happens in the interesting case? And that's what we want to know. This is far more tricky. And the purpose of this talk is to sort of try to shed some light on what's happening here, okay? So this is the problem we would like to tackle. However, this three-dimensional problem turns out to be quite challenging in both analytics and numerics. I certainly am not smart enough to do the numerics required to study this full thing. So what we are going to do is to reduce the problem to a two-dimensional problem. Before I go on, I forgot I had this slide, which is important. This problem has been studied before, and it has interested a lot of people before. So here I mentioned two works in particular that I found quite inspiring, which show basically this quantity is as before, this dynamic structure factor, or this dynamic response that they will be interested in. I should say this is obtained in inelastic neutron scattering. That was the data I showed before. And what these theoretical works show is that when you, of these two excitations that are monopoles classically, if you somehow bind one or disregard one, the other one forms a band of its own, or seems to be forming a band to a certain degree of approximation, right? So here you see this is momentum integrated, and this band here yields this broad part of the spectrum. And here we even have momentum resolution, and we see something that sort of behaves like a particle close to the zone center, but then as you go to the Brillouin zone boundary, you see that it becomes broader and weirder, okay? So these are inspiring works that motivated us, and also very current experiments are trying to also resolve this puzzle. I'm not showing the experimental data here because I'm not really convinced that we have reached the point yet that we can make a useful comparison, but these experimental results are also very interesting. So the question we want to ask is, we know that monopoles are deconfined from all the work in the classical ice, but are they freely, are their counterparts, the spin-ons, are they freely propagating quasi-particles in the system? And as I said, the three-dimensional problem is too complicated for me, and therefore I'm going to reduce the problem to two dimensions. Now, in two dimensions, I can form can formulate a similar problem, and instead of considering the pyrochlore lattice, I consider the checkerboard lattice, which is like you take this, you squash it to 2D, and you get the checkerboard lattice. Now, the model for the people who want to look at the Hamiltonian that we're going to be treating in a certain limit is the XXZ model, which looks like this. It has this easing term. These are nearest neighbor, easing terms. That nearest neighbor means in the checkerboard sense, right? And here, this is a transverse term that gives you the quantum mechanical fluctuations. This model has been studied a lot. The phase diagram in various regimes has been sort of mapped out. And one particular case is the strongly anisotropic limit, where one can formulate an effective model by let's say, rewriting this as plaquette flips. So let me quickly illustrate how the states look like in this case. So this is a square ice configuration. Again, the principle is the same as in 3D spin ice. We have two spins pointing in, two spins pointing out per plaquette. And this is the configuration that one configuration that one might get. I have colored the plaquettes such that, or the spin, sorry, such that for each yellow plaquette, the spins pointing out are red and the spins pointing in are blue. And this allows me also to do a mapping from these spins to hardcore bosons. And the model is exactly the same in either way you look at it. So now, this effective model that you can derive by doing perturbation theory on the original one tells you that there are processes where you flip all the spins in an uncrossed plaquette, whenever this plaquette fulfills a certain constraint, which is called you can say that if this plaquette is flippable, you flip all the spins. Okay, and this is this type of plaquettes here. Right, so you have it seems like you have something circulating here. So you take this and flip all the spins, and then you get another configuration in the ice manifold. Now, if you, on top of this, this is the term that is noted by T here. If on top of this you add a diagonal term that also acts on plaquettes like this, but just penalizes them in energy, you can arrive at a point where the Hamiltonian is exactly solvable. And this is the point marked by RK here. RK means Roxar-Kivelson point, and this comes from the study of dimer models. And at this point, your ground state is an equal amplitude and equal phase superposition of all the I states in the system. So this state is what people call quantum square ice. So whenever I say quantum square ice, I'm going to mean this state here. So this is a liquid state, and it's really just a state. It's not a phase. It's a critical point, right? So this is a difference compared to the 3D model that has an extended phase where you find quantum spin ice. Okay, so but there are recent results that show that whenever you raise the temperature, this this critical point becomes a phase, right? So here, for example, these are Monte Carlo results that show that this is the phase diagram, this is temperature, and this is this coupling that I had showed before, the plaquette flip, and this quantum Coulomb phase, as they call it, is this quantum square ice now, and. Again, from quantum Monte Carlo calculations, you can see that the excitations that we want to address here are indeed there, and actually they are deconfined as expected. So there are other excitations also in these models that are lower energy, but I'm not going to address them at all in this talk. I'm going to focus on these spin flip excitation zones. Okay, so yes.
Where the RK point is,
isn't
that zero?
Oh, here. That's a good question. I think it should be at zero. No, wait. No, this gamma point is the. So this gamma parameter is the This gamma parameter is the plaquette flip.
Is that the transversalized model that they studied with their galleys, the amplitude of the transverse
field? It is the transverse, yes. It is a transverse fieldizing model, yes. So in this case, this, okay, this is a good observation. So this is not quite the model that, it's not quite the same model as I show here, right? This is indeed the transverse fieldizing model on the checkerboard lattice, but I would say that this phase here extends from this point here, this RK point. I mean, it's similar in nature.
The transverse fieldizing model, I think, of that as some sort of models for the visons, or
Model for the visons in what sense?
Dual of the two gauge theory is the
I think that the transverse fieldizing model is not just it's not just related to vison. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah.
Can I say something? So here, if you really take the transverse fieldizing model and do in a limit where gamma is much smaller than J, and do degenerate perturbation theory, then you can actually go back to the you can derive this effective model where you are living in an ice manifold and you have plaquette moves where you flip all the spins around plaquettes. Unfortunately, you won't have this potential term that compete with the kinetic term in its effective model. So therefore, due to polyalphabet mechanism, so this model is actually can be solved as a compact QED in 2 plus 1D. Mm-hmm. So due to polyalphabet mechanism, you'll never have U1 spin liquid phase. So you're actually in the confinement side. Could you flip to the previous slide?
Uh-huh.
So I think it's corresponding to this on this axis. That would be V equals zero on this axis.
Yes, so that's, yeah.
Phase.
Right, right. So where you have maximal amount of flippable plaquettes. Mm-hmm. So however, once you, but we know that this mechanism only works when you are truly at zero temperature. So at a finite temperature, you can actually enter. So if the temperature scale is much bigger than whatever quantum tolerance scale or associated with instant quantum production, then you can actually enter this thermal regime. You actually, yeah, thermal regime where you actually have a thermal spin liquid. I mean, thermal spin liquid.
But is it different from Feynman?
I think it's different from that. I think it's different. I think I guess my perspective is different from yours. I think RK is a really a very special point in GD. So my take on this is that it's sort of the closest analogy that we can have to a truly 3D U1 spin liquid in 2D.
Yes. So what I wanted to say is the following. Actually, thank you for the interjection. So here, this is just a motivation for what I'm going to say. So indeed, what I'm going to focus on is just this point. Like, I'm not going to use any finite temperature stuff or address anything that has to do with the transverse fieldizing model. I just wanted to show you this, just to say that even though what we're studying now in this work is really related to just the RK point, there may be applicability even in an extended region of the phase diagram if you have a finite temperature. So that's the only thing I wanted to stress here.
So I forget now, but in that Chisberg letter, did they actually look at the dynamical structure factor at the finite temperature?
They did at very low temperatures.
They have S tau S zero, tau being the imaginary time.
Uh-huh.
So they can extract the energy gap at the given moment by looking at the exponential tail.
So basically, they have the lower bound of the dynamical structure.
So they use the exponential tail in the imaginary time correlation function to infer the minimal energy excitation at
right.
a given momentum.
Right.
So they identify that with the two-spin on fan buffer.
Yeah. Indeed, they don't get the full structure factor, but they get the lower bound of the continuum. Okay. Now I will get to business. So, just once more, this is the model. Again, I show you this mapping just to show the equivalence that this can be thought either as spins or hardcore bosons. What I wanted to stress before is that, as you can perhaps see here, these states have this peculiar property that they include, they contain paths or strings of either particles or spins. So if you follow the red spins here, you see that there's this sort of path forming. And also, let me see, here you have these, you have this loop, if you think that this, if you consider this as periodic, right? So people have talked for, that's just for the experts, but people in the literature, I've been told, have also considered visualizing these states as strings or loops, but typically they take, you know, the more straightforward approach where they just follow the arrows, right? In this case, if you do this thing a different way and you just take alternating arrows, you see that again you get strings or loops like this, but now these are essentially self-avoiding polygons, and I'm going to come back to this in a bit. Okay, this is the model, and now I'm going to study the strongly anisotropic limit, meaning that I'm going to take the Ising interaction to be very, very strong. And I'm going to consider the case where I have put an excitation into my system by hand. So if the Ising interaction dominates, this means that there's no effect of the Cambino effect of the transverse term if there's no excitation in the state, right? However, if there is an excitation, a spin flip in the state, then there is indeed dynamics that comes from the transverse term. And this is what I show here. Because now that I have put an excitation here, I have created two violations, and these violations can hop around. So if I do like a double spin flip, which in the Boson language is just a hopping, I can hop this violation from there to there, as it's shown there, without paying any extra cost. Okay, so I'm going to be discussing just this model now. Yes.
So is this just first order degenerate perturbation theory?
Actually, I think not, because strictly speaking, here, if you do perturbation theory, I think not, because here you're strictly speaking in the J z equals zero a equals infinity limit. Right, so there's no perturbative term that is generated. This is just the transverse term on its own without. See, I have not divided by any factors here.
Okay, zero order, whatever you want.
Yes, yes, yes.
So you just project it into this manifold.
Yes, yes. Okay. So yeah, this is indeed the model that I'm going to be focusing on from now on. And okay, I mean, you can drive it to an RK point. I don't want to focus on this too much. I just want to drive this model now to a few regimes where we can understand it analytically to a certain extent. So the first regime that I'm going to talk about is the regime where I put this excitation in there in a state, and then I constrain the two violations to be nearest neighbors. Always. I allow them to hop, but I don't allow them to detach from one another, right? So if you look at this for a while, you realize that there are two processes that are allowed. And in one process, you flip whenever you want to move this composite. You flip the common spin, and one where you don't flip the common spin. And these two processes are quite different, and we can isolate them in the numerics. So first of all, if we look at the process that I show on the left, this has been noticed before in the literature and has been called leapfrogging. And leapfrogging, what it does is basically it moves this object, this dipole, let's say, as a rigid object around in the lattice. But this is only allowed within the path that I mentioned earlier. So you have, if you look at this configuration, you have this path of blue blue arrows, which is violated at the point where I've made the spin flip, right? So now this excitation via leapfrogging, it can only move on this path. So you can diagrammatically show how the propagation goes by picturing it really just as a like a snake here. And of course, since the state with one excitation in it is a superposition of all these I states plus excitation, in the end, what you would get if you would try to evaluate the structure factor would be a superposition of all of these, right? And this is what I show here. This is the dynamic structure factor for the model without any excitations. So I put the spin flip in, and then I project it onto the eigenstates of the single excitation manifold of states. And the blue is what I obtain by doing large-scale exact diagonalization. The red is what I obtain if I consider all possible self-avoiding polygons that I can generate in my cluster up to a certain length. And then I define a tight binding model on each of these polygons. Is that relatively clear?
With free particles.
Free particles, yes. A free tight binding model. Actually, yes. So since it's a nearest neighbor tight binding model on each of these polygons, which means it's exactly solvable. Now to enumerate these, this is a primer. Yeah.
Sorry. So these energies you're finding, the whole spectrum is, it doesn't scale with system size because it's like one defect, right?
Right.
So how do you ignore, so like the higher turns in your perturbation theory, like the loop turns that would give you this arc, the PDRK point.
Yeah.
They'll give you extensive corrections to the energy. How do you?
Yeah. So these terms that you're describing come as something over JZ, right? Yeah, I set JZ to infinity.
But strictly. In the system, you'll have finite JZ, right?
And sure, indeed.
To make that limit work, you'd have to have JZ scale with the system size, which seems funny.
So say that again, I didn't get it. So I would have JZ scale with the system size.
Well, you have one defect and the energy is of order one, right? Then the rest of the bulk, if I added a tunneling term, would have an energy contribution of order n. Right, and so even if you put, you know, you have something over some power of JZ,
right,
you still have an N in front of it. Right?
Yes, but if I like, if I really consider JZ to be like a hardcore, constraint,
right, then to make that contribution smaller than that contribution, you would have to actually, it'd have to scale with that.
Sure, but that's always the case with perturbation theory for excitations. Somehow you're lucky that I think basically things cluster up, right? Like this contribution that comes from, you know, everywhere in space has nothing to do with the excitation. So it just some, you know, just shifts the overall ground state and it doesn't really shift the energy of the excitation.
That
can
make
well, okay,
sorry, maybe just continue.
Yeah, so indeed, to put the excitation in, you will have to pay an infinite energy cost, right? But this doesn't matter, really. I mean, just shift your spectrum. So here I have summed up to a certain length these contributions from all these self-avoiding polygons that I can make within this cluster. And okay, as you can see, I can get all the major peaks in the spectrum. And as I increase the length of these polygons and I take more and more of them into account, I show some of them here. This X is to show that some of them are not allowed due to the ICE rules. I get a reasonably good agreement to the spectrum. So this process, this leapfrogging process, we believe it can be just thought of as free propagation. The second process that we have in this regime of keeping the particles confined, we call it reconnection because we couldn't think of a better name. If you guys have a better name for it, I'd be happy to adopt it. And in this case, so the two violations sit, for example, here. And in this case, you propagate the composite particle by flipping not their common spin. You flip one other spin. So in this case, for example, I show what happens if you flip these two. And this is like hopping this guy from here to there. But in this case, you don't follow the path that I showed before. Actually, what you do is you modify this path. And in a certain regime, which I don't show here, but I can discuss later, for some of these smaller, so for some states that contain specific configurations, which turned out to be quite the most significant contribution to the spectra, this can be thought of as propagation on a 1D Lieb lattice. And the main feature of a 1D Lieb lattice, or any Lieb lattice, is that it has a non-dispersive band at zero energy. And if we consider only the smallest Lieb lattices within our clusters, again, we get something that gets this the dispersion of the intensity of this peak. And we get also all other secondary peaks, but we get them with the wrong with the wrong amplitude. And the reason for that is that in this case, the problem cannot be reduced to a, simply a non-interacting problem. There are remainders of correlations in this case. So what happens if I combine the two?
So what's a 1D Lieb lattice?
Sorry?
What's a 1D Lieb lattice?
A 1D Lieb lattice is, Lieb lattices in general are lattices of where two sublattices, particles on two sublattices can hop from one sublattice to the other via only via a third sublattice. In 1D, they would look like this. You would have a central sublattice here, and then two other sublattices, and that's your unit cell. And hopping can only be like this. It's like corners sharing squares. Now, this type binding model always has a flat band at zero energy. And I can show you how these arise later on. So now what I want to do is combine these two processes and find the total, let's say, kinetics of this composite particle. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to, in the small lattice that I have, or the finite cluster that I have, I'm going to average out all the possible configurations. I'm going to average out all the possible all the possible hoppings for all the possible configurations of this dipole, right? And when I do this averaging procedure, I come up with a tight binding model for a free dipole on the lattice, and I can come up with the hoppings for this, and I get nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor hoppings on the checkerboard lattice. So you may notice that if you look at the central particle here, you will notice that this dipole always hops on the checkerboard lattice. So I can infer, I can sort of deduce the hoppings, the average hoppings from counting many body configurations essentially and their weights in a finite lattice. And I come up with some numbers, which I now compare to numerics. So for numerics, we do exact diagonalization. This is what we find. This is the structure factor as a function of momentum in this irreducible wedge of the Brillouin zone. And the blue lines are what is calculated with exact diagonalization. The red lines are the tight binding, the average tight binding model we obtain for the system. So what we notice is the following. We have, at lower energies, we have the formation of sharp peaks, or sharper peaks, that disperse as one goes towards the zone boundary, right? And we also get remainders of this zero energy band from the Lieb lattice. So we have at low energies, we have something that looks like free propagation. At higher energies, we have something that looks like decoherence due to being stuck, of the two particles being stuck close to one another. So what we claim is that, okay, at lower energies, we can sort of, we can capture rather well, relatively well, this dispersion here. So this is evidence for us that that indeed this dipole becomes a coherent quasi-particle that disperses freely within the vacuum of ice states.
May I ask, why isn't the peak at the lowest threshold? Why isn't it completely sharp? Why is it
that? So if you have
is this dipole kind of floppy? Is that true?
So if you do this for a finite V, for a finite JZ, for a finite easing interaction, then what you find is that if you add the spin flip at the zero momentum, indeed what you get here, you would have something that looks like a delta function. But in the case where you really drive JZ equals to infinity, and that's because, you know, adding a spin flip at this momentum and at this energy, you really map to the ground state of the model with one spin flip in, right? So you really project to the ground state only. When JZ equals infinity, you can show that actually this is not the case. You don't project only to the ground state, so you expect that you will get weight also at other energies. This is the reason why this is not infinitely sharp.
But there is not a gap, or?
A gap?
Between like the lowest excitation and the...
Lowest excitation in?
Well, lowest energy, spin flip excitation. And...
Oh, yes. So, okay. So, this is the structure factor that I show here, and I start from the RK state, right? So, the energy that I take for the RK state is zero. Right? So, I mean, you're saying that, okay, this is at energies that are negative, and I'm talking about an excitation.
No. I'm saying that this, you know, this spin flip is somehow dragged by the, you know, by the photon of the RK state, and that's why there is a continuum there. Is that kind of simple way to understand it, or you can kind of always add a photon and two photons, three photons?
I think that it is in principle possible to also have photons on top of the spin-on. Right? This is what you're saying, so that you also have some sort of dressing of the peak because of, this is true. I think, even though I haven't checked explicitly, but I guess that's probably, we're saying the same thing. It could very well be that this is the case. Okay. So this looks rather okay. But this is not really what we set out to study. What we set out to study was the more realistic case where we don't artificially confine particles. We leave them free on the lattice. So here I show one such process where, you know, you start with the excitation that you have put in, and now with if you allow particles to hop, if you allow spin flips to happen, or, you know, exchange to happen, you see that the two particles start hopping away from one another. This case, we expect a priori that it's going to be more difficult, because now, even though these particles are free, and if you look at one, even if it's free and it has a well-defined band, now that you have two of them, the spectrum is going to look like the convolution of the band. So we expect something that's going to be broad anyway. So this is what we get. It's not a beauty, but we believe still that we can identify certain signatures of free propagation in here. So let me walk you through what I'm showing. So again, this is a structure factor as a function of energy. Again, for this irreducible wedge, the blue line is the numerically evaluated structure factor, and the red line is, again, an average tight binding model for which we have convolved the spectral function. right? So we really consider the spinons are free as free. We write down a tight binding for them. We obtain the bands, the spectral function, and then we convolve it with itself to obtain the joint density of states of these two spinons. And well, the first observation is that line shapes do not match. So these sharp peaks are essentially come from Van Hove singularities, which we do not see at all in the interacting spectrum. So this is a bummer. On the other hand, if we look at the lower bound of the structure factor, we see that the free calculation sort of envelopes the interacting one quite nicely as you go from the zone center to the zone boundary. There at the zone boundary, it's so and so. And then again, as you go, you come back towards the zone center, again, you recover a nice enveloping of the interacting calculation. So we believe this is reasonable because we don't expect a good agreement at high energies. And this is the same argument as I gave before. Like at higher energies, local processes that decohere your long range or your long range coherence of your particle, you expect them to compete. And in this case, especially in small lattices. So in this case, we don't really expect to capture the whole structure factor. What we do hope to sort of get an idea for is what happens at low energies, where the particles, by hopping, they lower their energy, and therefore it's preferable for them to become coherent across the whole lattice. Okay, so right, so this is the evidence we find of free spinons in these numerics. So I think this is also my main point. I can conclude here. First of all, I showed how the more easily manageable case of having the two spinons bound leads to something that looks like a particle band with sharp peaks at lower energies. And then as you go to higher energies, you find something that cannot be really explained as free particles. But at least at lower energies, you have something that is effectively coherently propagating in the lattice. Now, in the deconfined case, things are more complicated. But again, the same principle holds. At lower energies, you expect to find something that is coherent, is sort of consistent with free particle propagation. And at higher energies, well, we don't really understand yet exactly what is happening. So there are a couple of remarks that I'd like to make here. First, this result of having something that's well-defined close to the zone center where at lower energies is consistent with Yuan's calculations, who also found a similar thing. And that's, however, for the 3D case, for quantum spinites. And the second thing that I wanted to point out is this model that we studied is not yet the full complete picture of what might be happening. Of course, we are in one dimension lower, but I mean in real materials, we're one dimension lower. But also, we're missing some terms that might be important. And there are terms like this JZ plus minus, which is something that correlates the JZ, the Z component of a spin at one side with the transverse component on another side. And we have not yet taken this into account here. OK, then, of course, one might think how this can be extended. The most obvious thing is try to extend this to 3D. There, we would have to conceptually extend our method, because with exact diagonalization, we cannot go very far. So we're going to have to use either some hybrid approach or try our best to do quantum Monte Carlo. And perhaps another path one can follow is to introduce defects to try and bind one of the two particles, and then study the propagation of the other one in order to see something more like a sharp band, because then you have only one particle propagating. Okay, and so if you want to look at more more detailed discussion, this thing appeared, this our article appeared yesterday on the archive. You can check it there. Thank you for your attention.
So, are there any questions? So here in this, if you compare your exact agonized spectrum with this simple free particle picture.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that not only, so if you go to the the spectra, could you go to the slide?
Sure.
Actually, I noticed that somehow the position of the edge
mm-hmm.
from this simple free theory and the position of the edge in from ED are they don't actually quite match. Am I right?
Where?
So first, if you go to the 0, 0,
yeah,
then you see some tiny peaks at lower energy.
Oh yes.
And also in the red, so the red curve corresponds to this convolution of two free particles.
Right.
And it's essentially flat. But the not only that you don't see these peaks, but also the position of the edge where the spectrum goes to zero. They don't actually coincide.
No, they don't. No. This is indeed true. I mean, here you have these peaks. It's not really like a continuum, like the free calculation. But that's again, these peaks here are again because you land close to an eigenstate.
But I saw that the position of this edge is controlled by, I don't know, the bandwidth? Or, I mean, there's some very simple argument to determine where the edge is, right?
Basically, for the free theory.
The minimal, where the minimum energy is.
For the interacting?
I think for both cases.
Yeah, so indeed.
You can use this what's called Gershkorn theorem to bound the
position
of the...
Yeah, but I mean, this is true, yeah. But of course, in the finite lattice, there are many things that could be still happening, right? First of all, these particles that we model as free, at least in these clusters, mm-hmm. may not be exactly free because they are artificially close to one another all the time. So that might be one thing that's happening here. Another thing that might be happening. So you're referring to this difference here, right? Am I correct?
Right.
The red with the blue. Yeah. So another thing that might be happening is that due to the mass that these maybe these particles, even though they're free, they acquire some sort of mass because of their interaction with the background. So instead of having a fully, so it might be that their bandwidth is reduced because of that. And then, I mean, indeed, your argument is true. I can argue about the spectral radius or what the bandwidth here should be and where the lowest eigenvalue should be. But there's no a priori reason why they should match between interacting and non-interacting theory. Right. So for the non-interacting, it's really simple. Actually, it's at minus 12, and that's just because of the coordination of the lattice. Right. So if you put two particles, you have 12 states you can hope to, if they're far away. So
I see. Another quick comment is that so far you are exclusively looking at X and Z model.
Yes.
So we know that in 3D we have no choice because the transverse field term breaks the symmetry of the lattice.
Mm-hmm.
But in two dimensions, in principle, you can just add a transverse field term.
Mm-hmm.
And I would expect the dynamics can be very different because in this case. One spin-on hops on A sublattice, another spin-on hops on B sublattice. They
right.
never talk to each other.
Right.
Never on the same sublattice. But
mm-hmm.
with a transverse field term, then they could be in the same sublattice. So you don't have additional conservation law.
Right.
So with X and Z, you have U1 symmetry. So you have additional conservation law. But,
right.
So in relation to real materials, I have seen papers discussing about using this simple checkerboard transverse field IC model
mm-hmm.
to describe certain organic salt.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, it's of experimental relevance to study this transverse.
It is. But the conservation law that you mentioned is what enables our calculations. in a transistor, right? So because, so there's a lot of technicality for the numerics here, because in order to be able to do these sizes, we need to conserve the particle number, or the, sorry, the magnetization sector, let's put it this way. So, so in principle...
Precisely because you can
right.
have to put one spin to one spin.
Yeah,
so the Hilbert space dimension is much smaller.
Also, I mean, for real materials, it turns out that if you do the mapping, or sort of the fitting to experimental data for terbium titanate, let's say, it turns out that this term is appreciably large, right? But again, this term also, it also has the same problem. We cannot... You simply cannot, I can't do the numerics for that, but it's going to be like, instead of how many am I showing here, maybe 10, 12 momenta, maybe a bit more. It will be 6. So, yeah.
What about the high frequency discrepancy between the ED and the model?
Yeah, I don't know. So there's a peculiar thing here. That you have this a really straight upper bound, which is the same at all momenta for the non-interacting calculation. And that's because the bands are such, if for this side binding model, the bands are such that indeed the energy the highest energy difference you can have for all momenta is exactly at this energy. So this this is just a, I don't know whether it's a coincidence or something that has physical value. Regarding this discrepancy here, I really have no good answer. So obviously, if you reach these energies, you definitely do not have free particles, right, anymore? Because free particle theory tells you that you cannot even have that. So it's probably a decohered contribution that comes from correlations. So that's my estimate, but I don't know what it is. Yeah.
So it seems that even the sum rules are not really respected here. So if you look at the area under the curves,
yes,
there has to be a sum rule for SKQ omega integrated with omega, right?
Yes.
So it seems that they don't match. I mean, the red curves are significantly bigger in terms of area.
Oh, yeah, that's a different scale.
So and can you like scale down the curve such that the respect the
yes
respect the
yeah, yeah, yeah.
sample
rules? Yes, but the problem is that then you would not see where they ascended. This is why I've blown it up, right? So also there's another thing here that you might think that some of the momenta have more weight than the other momenta. That's because here the blue lines, so the thin lines are really the peaks and the magnitude of the matrix elements that I get, and then I do I overlay everything with a Lorentzian to make a nice curve to compare, and in some of the momenta I have fewer peaks, and in some of the momenta I have more peaks, and that's because this is for two different lattices, one 72 sites, the other one 64 sites. So when you have fewer momenta, the overall weight is going to be lower. When you do the convolution,
okay.
Right? But the sum rule has been explicitly checked here, and it checks out. Right?
Well, if there are no further questions, let's thank Stefan again.
Thank you.